Welcome to Friday and welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and this next hour, this is where we learn from the major events of the week. I want to welcome my panelists today. Jossie Ross, local writer and attorney. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Erica C. Barnett, blogging at thecisforcrank.com. Hi, welcome back.
Hello.
Pat Murakami, South Seattle neighborhood activist, president of the South Seattle Crime Prevention Council. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you.
First of all, I just want to say that the most shocking thing that happened this week, in North Seattle anyway, was the gas explosion in Greenwood that somehow didn't kill anybody. Three businesses are gone, dozens damaged. The people who live there lost a piece of their neighborhood. So I just want to extend our sympathies to those folks. I hope you all recover well and quickly. What's happening right now that I want to get to is that Seattle city officials have just cleared out a homeless encampment on South Dearborn Street.
Shame on you! Shame on you! You're not being assaulted. I haven't touched you. You're a liar, all of you. You profit off of people's hardship.
She's hurting my ear.
KUOW reporter Liz Jones gathered that audio because she was just there at the Dearborn site and back in the studio. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
Why did the city clear out this homeless camp today?
Well, basically, it comes down to people trespassing on private property. The Nicholsville organization had been running this or managing this site since it opened temporarily in 2014. But just a few months ago in January, there was an internal conflict that kind of erupted at the site. The residents there voted to oust their management, the Nicholsville management, and that led to the loss of other official support for this encampment. The city or the church sponsor pulled out, the private property owner pulled out, and basically requested the city to go in and clear the site. So that's what was happening this morning. The Nicholsville management also wanted to retrieve some of their belongings there on site, some of the building materials. There are several tiny house structures on the site, so they were there to recover that property.
I want to get at the person we just heard yelling, shame on you. Who was living at this Dearborn camp?
Right. City officials say there were 16 people there on site when they arrived early this morning. Some residents say that included two pregnant women, but I did not see them. Some people were arriving late. Apparently, they'd had belongings there or had, you know, maybe not been living there just the past couple of days or had not been there the past couple of days. People had known this was coming, though. They received an eviction notice at least, you know, 2 weeks ago. They knew it was imminent. They just didn't know. I think people thought it was maybe going to be tomorrow, so they were a little caught off guard this morning. But residents did say that it was a peaceful process this morning for the most part.
Who was yelling, shame on you? What was that audio about?
That was more related to the internal conflict there. That was a woman who had been living at the encampment yelling at a woman named Peggy Hotz, who's part of the Nicholsville management, and some dispute there about how it was being managed, who were being allowed to stay at the camp if you were caught with drugs or alcohol or not doing your security shift. People were reprimanded for that or moved out of the camp. So there was some conflict happening there.
Okay. So how have residents responded to being cleared away out of this Dearborn encampment?
Yeah. Like I mentioned, most people kind of went voluntarily, felt that it was pretty peaceful, that police treated them fairly. Some people there were very visibly upset, kind of wondering what they were going to do next. One gentleman I talked to, his name was Stephen McKnight. He lived at this encampment for 5 months. He said he plans to go live under the viaduct near the stadium, not quite the jungle area, but near the jungle. He said he's worried about what's going to happen next to people who might end up on the street.
People die. People get killed. I've been on the streets. I've seen people shot dead right in front of my eyes. I've seen children shooting up freaking heroin, you know? I mean, that's what they need to work on.
So there you can hear he's quite upset about what he thinks he'll be safe himself. He'll find a way to survive out on the street, but he's worried about what might happen to other people that he got to know there at the camp.
Yeah, he'll be under the viaduct. Where else? What else do you know about where these folks are going to go next?
Right. So the 16 people there, city staff did have other people there on site to help with counseling, help connect people to services. Of the 16, 10 are going into what the city considered more stable housing. 8 are going to the new Othello Village encampment that just opened this week near the Othello station. 2 are going into other shelter services, and 6 were striking out on their own. So it's unclear where they're going to end up, but they opted not to take up the city's offer for services or other placement.
Reporter Liz Jones just back from this Dearborn site, the homeless encampment, to clear it out today. I understand you took some photographs of what all that looked like.
Yeah, I sure did.
Okay, well, let's send those out. We're live tweeting the show, of course, at KUOW, so we'll tweet out those photos. Liz, thanks for telling us about it.
You're welcome, Bill.
Now to our panel, who I welcomed a couple of minutes ago. This is an example of the city. We have now three city-sanctioned homeless encampments and the city clearing out this unsanctioned one. What do you think of this approach, Pat?
Well, while sanctioned encampments are certainly better than unsanctioned ones, we shouldn't tolerate people living in tents and sheds. That's not a respectable way for people to live.
What's your alternative?
I think we should be giving people housing vouchers, and then they can, at market rates, so they can go and get apartments or rooms somewhere and live in decent conditions with running water and electricity.
Erica C. Barnett, your response to the sanctioned encampments and clearing out the unsanctioned ones?
Well, I think fundamentally, you know, people have to live somewhere. The solution of vouchers is not really a solution at all for most people because it's very, very hard to get housing on a Section 8 voucher. There are very long waiting lists to get those vouchers, and even if we funded them, a lot of landlords won't let people live in their apartments on vouchers. So, I mean, the deal is, you know, these are human beings. They have to sleep somewhere. And I'd rather they be in sanctioned encampments where they can get services. But I also recognize that there are a lot of reasons people don't go into encampments and don't, you know, want to live that structured lifestyle with a lot of rules about when you can come and go, what you can do there. And, you know, people make choices for reasons. And so I do agree that until we get housing, and this will get to kind of the housing first model that I hope we're going to talk about. But until we get people into housing, to say that they just can't be on the streets and they have to be swept, quote unquote, is really unrealistic because they have to go somewhere.
Before we get to Jossie, I just want your reaction, Pat, to Erica saying vouchers aren't the answer. They're too hard to get, et cetera.
They just need to expand the program and give landlords incentives for accepting the vouchers.
Okay, Jossie Ross, how are you reacting to the news today?
Well, I think it's indicative of sort of the ad hoc patchy approach that the city of Seattle has had. It seems like, and I want to acknowledge Bill Hobson, his recent passing, because he was a tireless advocate, and his motto that, you know, there was no throwaway person is absolutely correct. And it's important, I think, that we understand his prescience, his sort of psychic ability to see this oncoming, crisis that we have now, and that we have to actually have proactive solutions. So the specific question you asked, Bill, how do I feel about this? I feel it's completely congruent with Mayor Ed Murray's non-coherent approach, or actually it seems like non-approach to leadership on this homelessness issue, where there's a series of you know, talking points and maybe a proclamation to or the declaration of a state of emergency, but no real action and no real positive action that's going to try to alleviate the strain, both for today, which, you know, both sanctioned and unsanctioned camps might do. And we can argue the merits of that. But the truth is, people have to sleep, right? They have to have some place to live. And then long term, how we move into, you know, things like vouchers and residency for, you know, what we would consider respectable residency for these homeless people. So we have to look at, I think, more of a comprehensive approach. And that's something that simply hasn't happened, and that's something that Bill Hobson has encouraged for a very long time.
Since you brought up Bill Hobson, for those who don't know, this week, or I guess maybe very late last week, Bill Hobson, one of Seattle's leading homeless advocates, died, and the idea that he's most associated with is the idea of housing first. So here is Bill Hobson telling us the way to help a homeless person succeed is to give them a place to live.
If you eliminate the chaos of homelessness from a person's life, if you get rid of all the craziness that homeless people have to endure when they're living on the streets or in shelters, where they're almost monomaniacally preoccupied with survival, if you eliminate that, hey, that game is over, survival is assured, it provides a more stable foundation for people to begin to address their challenges and make serious changes in their lives.
So that's Bill Hobson advocating for the idea of housing first, which may or may not sound uncontroversial to you. But Pat Murakami, we've talked before about how you don't think housing first is the way to go. Why is that?
Well, a couple things. One, I think it's a boondoggle for developers. They build those structures at just a ridiculous cost per square foot. And you can't just throw housing at people. You have to look at the whole person. They need other wraparound services, mental health, drug treatment, and job counseling. And when we just treat people like little Lego statistics and build housing units and don't look at the whole person, we're never going to succeed.
Erica C. Barnett, I know you support strongly the idea of housing first. What do you say to all that? The people have problems besides, their problems don't disappear when they're inside four walls.
No, but they don't. But as Bill Hobson pointed out in that interview, once you solve the chaos of homelessness, I think that's a really good way of putting it. You know, once you solve the need to just survive minute to minute, you solve a lot of problems that, you know, that enable people to then turn to their other problems. And, you know, I hear a lot of people saying, well, this isn't the solution for everything. This isn't the solution for everything. And, you know, and sort of demanding a solution to everything all at once, tied up in a beautiful little bow. The idea of housing first, you know, looks at that more as a procession of things. So you get housing first, not housing only. And when that happens, you actually do have much better access to services, to addiction treatment, to mental health services than you do living in, say, the jungle or in, you know, in these encampments that get pushed further and further out of sight by neighbors who don't like looking at them. And so to me, getting people into housing first, you can get a job. It's really hard to get a job if you don't have an address.
So Pat, it's not housing only, it's housing first. Why not get people out of the chaos and desperation of homelessness and then start addressing everything you talked about, mental health, addiction, job counseling?
I think it needs to happen in tandem. And we've had people that have been in DESC housing that have murdered people or assaulted people.
DESC is the Downtown Emergency Service Center. Bill
right.
Hobson's organization.
Right. We have housed people who have done that.
Right. So you have to, we're not putting enough money into mental health and drug treatment and other supportive services. And again, I think that a lot of the construction is a great profit-making device for developers, and we don't do enough, we don't build enough units for the money we spend.
Josie, what's your take?
Well, somebody's going to make a profit on this either way. And I would rather have homeless people housed while making that profit. I agree that in an ideal world with limitless resources that we would address all of those things at the same time. And hopefully there is an incremental approach where we start to add services upon services upon services in addition to housing. However, having, you know, come from a family that where exigent circumstances and having worked as a public defender where I saw people in exigent circumstances, people do react differently. And some might
give us an example of that, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I started off my legal career at mental health court, civil commitments. And you see people when they have absolutely no services, obviously confidentiality, I can't talk about specific cases, but you see people who are manic one day. And you see that it's a combination of things, absolutely, that where, you know, they're off their meds, they're homeless, they don't have services, they're hungry. All of those things add stress and duress to a particular person. I'm not saying anything new, but when you start to sort of by regression analysis, take away those stimulants, you know, perhaps give them a stable place to live, you see people responding differently. And I've seen
why. How does that work? Like Erica said, you can get a job more easily when you have a home.
Absolutely.
Give us an example of how housing changes somebody.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example from my own life. At one time, my family was homeless. And the reason why was because we didn't have established credit, couldn't afford first and last month's rent. You can't check into school. Or at one time, it's very difficult, administratively difficult to check into school. It's difficult to access services. And those sort of thing compounds. Well, now you're kind of a nobody. You're a blip on the radar that nobody knows. And so now you're trying to check into school later on. And it just accumulates. Those stimulants and those stressors just accumulate. And you see it time and time again at courthouses. And you see those in social services offices that this just compounds. Simply not having an address, a place to collect mail, compounds the already existent problems, the very real problems that Pat talked about.
So, Pat, how do you respond to that? We're hearing the people have can have a constellation of problems, but the addiction, mental health, job counseling can take a long time. But housing first is the first step. What do you say?
We need more oversight. The facility that was built by DESC in the Rainier Valley was at a higher per square foot cost than building a luxury house on Lake Washington. So we need to hold our nonprofits accountable for results. They need to use our tax dollars thriftily and have three units to the cost of the old one. There's no excuse for the waste.
Well, that luxury house on Lake Washington, first of all, judging anything based on the per square footage cost is a little specious, because you're talking about, I mean, this is the same argument against micro housing. You're talking about what people can afford. And DESC housing, unlike the luxury house in Lake Washington, has services. It has all those services that you were saying that you want. Now, not enough of them. There's not an I agree completely that there's not an adequate supply of treatment, of mental health help, of all the things that we need for homeless people to be, you know, fully reintegrated into society and healthy. But it's going to cost more to build that kind of housing that it's going to cost to build a private home. And, you know, and I would just reiterate something that was said, you know, somebody's going to profit. And ultimately saying, oh, well, these are the wrong people to be building this housing, or we need more oversight first, or we need everything to be solved all at once, is a way of saying, let's just not address this problem.
Okay, we are going to move on. Jossie's raising his hand, and because Pat's outnumbered, she'll get the last word. Jossie.
Well, and I don't even think it's outnumbering Pat. I respect her views. However, I think it's important. And one of the good things that's happened in recent conversations, specifically regarding Black Lives Matter, body cams, which is going to come up later on,
yes,
is that a lot of times when we talk about corrective measures, we're speaking from an incredible position of privilege. We have the ability to pontificate and ponder these things from a distance. Well, there's real life homeless people out there. And I think it's always important to consider that while we're waiting for this ideal, we still have to deal with the limited resources, the finite amount of time and attention that we can deal with this. And sometimes the best that we can do at this particular moment is not ideal. And sometimes that has to be good enough.
Pat, are you coming from a place of privilege that blinds you a little bit? I'm not saying you're not a compassionate person, but, you know, there's people urgently and desperately suffering now. Are you yes, go ahead.
I
want you to respond.
Okay, I'm comparing apples to apples. I'm comparing construction cost to construction cost.
Yes.
And then on top of that, DESC is spending the money on the support and the staff. So we need oversight of the construction costs. Bring it down. We could have had triple the number of units if it had been done properly. We would have been housing 150 people instead of just 50.
Okay, we need to obviously just keep reporting on this, keep reporting on the cost of our different options, Housing First and all these other kinds of services, which we will hear on KUOW. Thank you for being in it right now in this conversation. And we're going to continue with the Week in Review in just a moment. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I want to thank Donald Trump. Thanks to Trump, we were having an honest conversation about how Americans are feeling, like it or not, until this week when suddenly the media were obsessed with this.
Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee.
A low point in American politics, said the commentators. But University of Washington historian Margaret O'Meara told me that American politics have always been vulgar, depending on how you even define vulgar.
In the 19th century, it was actually seen as kind of below a presidential candidate's dignity to actually do any campaigning at all. It was seen vulgar to give a speech, full stop.
Interesting.
And so, our definition of vulgarity has changed over time. That's one thing to think about.
Vulgar changes. Jossie, when you look at the discourse in this election, what do you find vulgar?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's the little, to me, low-hanging fruit, things like the hands and the curse words and stuff like that. But what I find vulgar is the constant and unchecked references to Islamophobia, the fact that two major presidential candidates are saying that, you know, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, that number one, that we're not going to allow any Muslims to come into the country, or alternatively, Ted Cruz saying that perhaps we should surveil mosques. And that hasn't raised a red flags all across the nation.
It hasn't?
No, not at all. I mean, obviously, there's a group of people, the intelligentsia, the people who are in here and the folks who read Politico and Huffington Post who are opposed to that. But largely, those statements have been unchecked. Absolutely. And moreover, the racial rhetoric, a black man getting punched in the face at a Donald Trump event, that's vulgar to me. And just the constant, you know, and also on the side that many of us, I suspect all of us within this room, would consider themselves to be a Democrat, their inability to articulate the language that says, yes, this is indeed racist. They were asked about that directly at the debate, both of them, including the candidate who I support, Bernie Sanders, and Hillary Clinton. And they asked, is this racist? And for me, I'm not the smartest person in the world, but to me, racism is as racism does. When I hear somebody, you know, prompting this racial rhetoric and encouraging Muslims to be removed from rallies and encouraging black student protesters who aren't doing anything outside of the rule of law, aren't doing anything disrespectful, to be removed, who say that 11 million Mexicans should be deported, who say that we should close the borders to Muslims, that's racist to me.
Why do you think the Democratic candidates aren't using the word racist?
I think that there's a it's the same reason that Hillary Clinton didn't answer the question in 2008 the right way when she was asked whether or not presidential nominee Barack Obama was a Muslim. And she said, I don't think so. Instead of saying, why are you asking this question? This is a completely inappropriate question. I think there's still an unwillingness to point out very obvious truths that harm us, people of color, that white folks, to put it frankly, don't feel, cannot empathize with, and don't understand the absolute horrible nature of even those questions being asked.
Erica C. Barnett, you can respond to that, or you can tell me what's vulgar in your world.
Well, I mean, I would say, going back to the historian, that it's absolutely true that, you know, we've been talking about, you know, even like the presidential member
yes,
for a very long time. Look at LBJ
yes,
and Jumbo.
Yes.
I'll say no more. And so this is not like exactly shocking in any way to me. I mean, I do think that this particular conversation is intended to enforce the idea that the president is traditionally a man.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean that if you're talking about the size of your junk, you know, that is very much in contrast to a female president,
yeah,
or female presidential candidate, and sort of reinforcing that idea of manliness as a presidential quality. As far as vulgarity, you know, I think Donald Trump is vulgar, but I think he is saying he is the unfiltered id of the Republican Party. And as Rubio said just the other night, you know, Donald Trump, you're just saying what everyone wants to say. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he said. And so the fact that everyone, you know, I think in the Republican Party who's running right now essentially agrees with Trump and would supports the same policies and even more extreme versions of the same policies that Donald Trump supports, you know, speaks is much more vulgar than the fact that Donald Trump is willing to actually say it.
Pat Murakami, what's vulgar to you in this campaign?
All of the above. And I think under a bigger umbrella, in society as a whole, we've become more vulgar, where bullying, Real Housewives series is a prime example. We need to respect everyone, and we need to be respectful of our Constitution, which ensures freedom of religion. That's what the country was founded on, for crying out loud. And to exclude people, to put down another candidate on things other than issues, is a waste of the public's time.
Here's a way to put it. I'm curious if anyone else is going with me and Sarah Silverman here. Yeah, you mentioned Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, by Mr. War on Poverty, Mr. Civil Rights Act, was vulgar. We have monuments to presidents who were slaveholders and Indian killers. They weren't vulgar. I find the tisking about manners to be classist and elitist and irrelevant, and maybe the kind of thing that annoys people about elites. But who said it better this week was comedian Sarah Silverman, who appeared as Adolf Hitler on Conan O'Brien's show. So here, Sarah/Hitler wants you to know how frustrating it is to be compared to Donald Trump.
Don't get me wrong, Conan. I agree with a lot he says, a lot. Like 90% of what he says. I'm like, this guy gets it.
Okay.
But it's just, I don't like the way he says it. It's just... It's crass.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Trump is very, very crass, yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes I watch him and I'm like, is that how people see me? You know, like...
Hitler wondering, is that how really how people see me? Agree. Can we drop the vulgar core stuff and stick to the issues, or am I out on a limb?
Let's do it.
Okay. Yes?
Oh, I was just going to say, I honestly don't care if Donald Trump is coarse. I think in some ways, I think it's a great thing because it's shining a light on what the actual beliefs behind the policies of the Republican Party at this moment are.
I think that, you know, the tone, once again, the racism, the Islamophobia, you know, the fear, migrant fear, those things are more vulgar than the actual language. To me, that's low-hanging fruit, and it doesn't really have any much substantive merit. And in fact, I think Donald Trump obviously has tapped into something where people are tired of professional career politicians. And I think that to have some actual impromptu speech is good. It just doesn't have to be hateful.
So I'll give the last word on that to our historian, University of Washington's Margaret O'Meara.
Vulgarity, or being outrageous, is kind of the bright, shiny object that distracts us from real issues.
Okay, so enough of that. Can we talk about the issues now? Okay, good. let's. And there are so many issues, and we have so much time to talk about them all in this presidential campaign. So let's, since we have you here, Jossie, pick one issue, the one issue you want to highlight right now that you feel passionate about, that your favorite candidate is talking about.
Well, I feel that... There's a lot of issues. I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, but I feel that there's one issue in the most recent debate in Flint, Michigan, that kind of crystallized why I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders as opposed to Hillary Clinton. And that was, there was a question asked regarding fracking. Fracking is something within, I think all the United States has an interest in it, but within Native communities, it has a specific, insidious, ugly, nasty, economically predatory nature to it.
Tell me about that.
Well, because we come from largely very, very large land bases that have been economically underdeveloped, but have rich, rich mineral resources and natural resources. And so a lot of times foreign development companies come in there and they dangle a carrot in front of you and say, we'll give you pennies on the dollar in order to be able to exploit this natural resource. It's economically predatory. And so fracking is one of those things to say we need to get at your mineral rights. Well, Bernie was asked about this. Well, first of all, Hillary Clinton was asked first, and she gave this extremely long and incoherent answer that showed that she had listened to 30 different control groups, test groups, and polling about this particular matter, and ultimately didn't give a response about fracking. And Bernie was asked about it right afterwards and says, no, I don't support fracking. And to me, that crystallized that there's a line in the sand, which his morals, his integrity, outside of control groups, outside of polling, won't let him move past. And I think that's a very, very refreshing state.
Erica, yes? You want to talk?
I'm hopping up and down in my chair.
I know.
Well, I think Bernie is in a position where he is able to say things in very simple terms, simple black and white ideological terms, in part because he is an ideological candidate rather than a transactional candidate, which is what I think Hillary Clinton is. So
you're a Clinton supporter.
I am a Clinton supporter. I was in 2008 as well. And so the issue I would point to that actually is sort of a similar situation was abortion rights. And they haven't been asked about abortion in any of the debates. They were asked about it at the Fox News town hall of all places. And basically the question was, do you support any restrictions on abortion rights? Bernie didn't exactly answer that question, but he did give his talking point, which is that he is 100% pro-choice. That is absolutely true. He has checked the box every single time the right way. He has 100% rating from NARAL. Hillary Clinton, in contrast, gave a much more nuanced answer, which, you know, talked about, well, I do support some restrictions in the third trimester, as does NARAL. I mean, as does everybody. No one is saying let's have abortion up until the moment of birth, which is what the Republicans are trying to to stick on Hillary. But she said, you know, but let's talk about what the actual issue is today in America, which is access. Women do not have access to abortion. And if you don't have access, saying that I support the right is meaningless. So we have all these trap laws. We have a major Supreme Court case right now that's going to determine whether most of the clinics in Texas shut down, and eventually, I mean, could determine whether clinics across the country shut down. And no one's talking about that. And so for Bernie to say, I support abortion rights, that's great. I'm glad he checks the box. But there's a difference between being an ally, which Bernie is, and a champion, which Clinton is.
So there are two takes on Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And I know that right now our listeners are upset because they're not hearing from a Republican. Our listeners value diversity above all. And they're saying, where are the conservatives? Boy, am I going to hear it. So I just want to explain to you that we did have a Republican booked on this show, and that Republican had to back out. And
Pam Roach.
What about you, Pat Murakami? But pick your issue and then tell me who your candidate is that's actually talking it up.
And sorry that I'm not supporting Trump, but I don't want my son engaged in World War III. But I support Bernie Sanders. And the primary reason is I think the biggest problem facing this country is the economic disparity. And if we don't address that, we will return to the 1920s of mega wealthy and serfs. And we're headed that way now. And I think it's critical that we look at everybody paying their fair share and not using public resources to make the wealthy even wealthier.
What is it that Sanders will do to make us more equal?
I think he will hold corporations accountable. He's talking about a $15 an hour minimum wage across the country. And my problem with that, while I'm not disagreeing with the idea, it can't be done in a bubble. If we don't hold pricing and the cost of goods in check, then that
how would we do that?
We're going to have to start regulating publicly traded corporations.
Telling them what they can charge?
We're going to have to really look at them. They're taking public funds. They're taking public investment. And it shouldn't all be going to the CEO so that he can live in five mansions. We need to have proper taxation of corporations, proper taxation of the wealthy, and proper wages.
What public funds are you talking about that corporations are taking?
Well, they're not paying taxes. I mean, GE is an example. Okay, so that's coming out of the middle class. The middle class is shrinking. We have more homeless people. I mean, it all plays in.
If only the Republican hadn't backed out, the Republican would say that's GE's money, not the taxpayers' money.
Well, and I would say just to get back to my issue du jour, my issue of choice, fixing campaign finance reform, which is another of Sanders' big talking points, and taxing corporations and even fixing income inequality is not going to solve problems like access to abortion. And it's not going to solve problems, you know, like sexism, and it's not going to solve racism. And, you know, even if we fix the economy, there's going to be a lot of other issues that, you know, that are considered sort of that I think the Sanders camp thinks will be swept under, you know, or swept into fixing income inequality and will also be fixed. But, you know.
Well, maybe Pat's just prioritizing income inequality.
I am. I'm.
Triage.
Triage.
Yeah. And I would prioritize human rights, which I think abortion is a human right.
Well, abortion's not going anytime soon because
it is.
Well, the most abortions are done in the red belt states, so I think they're going to make sure it remains available.
Well, I can tell you from coming from a red belt state and from a southern deep south state that it is very hard to get an abortion in Mississippi right now, and it's very hard to get an abortion in Texas right now, and grew up in both those states. And so, sure, they still exist. But the searches for DIY abortions, as New York Times reported this week, have skyrocketed because people are trying to find solutions where abortions are not available.
In regards to that, empirically, most of the abortions do happen in the southern states. So that's a statistical, you know, topic. And, you know, regarding, I appreciate the comment that economic inequity and fixing that would not solve racism and issues like that. One of my mentors slash good friends, his name is Van Jones, and he has a concept, says that nothing stops a bullet quicker than a job. And so his contention is that, you know, and he's a fairly learned person, the green economy, et cetera, that, you know, regarding how economic development in traditionally undervalued communities, like communities of color, how that will, in fact, help to alleviate certain social problems. And so there's a good deal of scholarship that's available regarding how fixing economic inequality will, in fact, fix a lot of those social ills. Moreover, I think the most important way that Bernie, however, would look toward fixing the income gap is by education. Access to education. When I was walking in here on University Ave, I seen a group of young folks who probably are being taxed with an incredibly, high interest rates on their student loans and the student loans themselves. The tuition is extremely high, much higher than when I was in school. And just increasing that gives people a fighting chance. And so, you know, that I think is an amazing inroad in toward creating multi-generational wealth and alleviating some of those social ills that, you know, we've talked about already.
Let me tell you, though, women are not going to get to the top of the tech ladder, for example, based on education. Women are more educated than men, and we're still not hired for a lot of jobs or even considered.
Okay, we'll much more about Sanders and Clinton to come in weeks and months. We're going to talk about some other news of the week. But I do, before we leave the election, maybe it's even a quick thing. I just want to know, the Seattle Times endorsed John Kasich and Bernie Sanders this week. Surprised? Do you care?
Kasich sounds reasonable. I've read about his history. He's crazy. However, when I hear him at the debates, he sounds incredibly reasonable. If I didn't know him, if I didn't read about his record, I would probably, you know, like go hang out with him, watch some football with him. But knowing his, you know, so I get the endorsements. I'm just not believing it.
Well, that's on the Republican side. But right. The Seattle Times, the business friendly, the downtown newspaper, endorsed your man, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, at some point there are two solid interests there, because Seattle Times also recognizes that a lot of their constituencies are very ingratiated into an environmental movement and environmental consciousness here in the, you know, faux liberal Pacific Northwest.
So you thought it was good market research going into that endorsement?
Yeah. I thought it was just absolutely bizarre. The first the endorsement of Kasich was based on the fact that he doesn't seem crazy, and the endorsement of Bernie was based on the fact that he has better ideals. So I mean, so you're basing one. I mean, the Kasich endorsement was basically like, his ideals stink. Everything he wants to do is terrible or wouldn't work. And but we think he sounds better than the other candidates, you know, behind a lectern. And Bernie, it was, we like his ideals and we would like to see, you know, the breakup of the banks. And it's like, what were these written by two different newspapers? It was just really bizarre.
Pat, do you care about newspaper endorsements anymore?
No, I think voters need to be critical thinkers, decide for themselves. And all endorsements, if you follow the money trail, there are motivations behind them. And
Whose endorsements matter to you?
I don't really look at anybody's endorsements. I make decisions for myself, and if I don't have enough information, I skip that candidate. I don't vote for anybody if I don't know enough. Thank you. As someone who's served on quite a few editorial boards in my day, I can tell you I never made a penny off endorsing one candidate or another, nor was ever asked, you know, by a publisher to sway my endorsement one way or my vote on the endorsing body one way or another.
You don't line. You don't print out the endorsement. I print out the endorsements,
really?
Multiple endorsements, and I kind of.
I do.
I mean, I take into account what I know, what I think, what that person says, my guess on where they come from, and then these people over. I sort of triangulate. You know, how do you do it?
Well, the Seattle Times, for example.
You just know everything?
The Seattle Times, for example, their endorsement is based on where their money comes from, and that's from their advertisers.
I take that into account.
My grandmother did. I mean, so, you know, congratulations. I hope you can cook good, because then you have two things in common with an amazing woman.
But, she sounds nice.
Yeah, but I never heard of it. People actually paying attention to endorsements.
Okay.
I hear about people paying attention, but I don't personally. I mean, I'm with Pat. I educate myself on the candidates and, you know.
I don't say I don't educate myself. I crowdsource it. I crowdsource my vote a little bit. Maybe I should be ashamed. Okay, more of the Week in Review coming back up in a moment. Okay, maybe I wasn't clear enough. I'm not printing out endorsements of who to vote for president. I can figure that out. But I'm talking down that ballot when I know less and less compared to the people who research more and more. Now am I crazy?
No, it makes sense.
That makes sense.
You're a good man.
back in the fold.
Glad you're voting.
Glad someone's voting. We're talking with Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com, Pat Murakami, South Seattle Crime Prevention Council, Jossie Ross, local writer and attorney on KUOW's Week in Review. Okay, let's jump back in. This week, Washington lawmakers debated what to do with all the video recorded on police body cameras. Seattle and other cities are on the way to putting these little cameras on officers' uniforms, and whatever those cameras record is government property, which means you, the public, can request to see it. But Kitsap County Democrat Drew Hansen says there are some things you should not be allowed to see.
Incidents of domestic violence, the inside of a private home, the body of a murder victim, that can be requested in a Public Records Act request and put up on YouTube by somebody who wants to make money selling ads. And this is happening right now in cities all over the state that are using body cameras. That's what the bill addresses.
Okay, he wants to restrict access to some body camera video, but he does not go far enough, according to the ACLU's privacy advocate, Jared Friend. Friend wants to make it even harder to see body cam footage.
Most of these records, most of the video that's going to be captured by these body cameras just isn't that important. Most of it is just going to be officers doing their job and people kind of going about their day. So let's just limit access generally, right? Let's delete these things fairly routinely unless there's reason for us to keep it around.
Those reasons to keep it around, to not delete, according to Jared, to the ACLU, Jared Friend, those reasons would be if the officer used force, don't delete. If a citizen complains that the officer did something out of line, or if you can show that the video relates to police accountability, otherwise erase it. Pat, who should see body camera footage and why?
Well, I agree with the ACLU's stance on that 100%. The more public disclosure requests we get, the more resources the police department has to put into finding that film and making it available, and then they're not out patrolling. So anytime there's a questionable act by an officer, a citizen complains, I agree. We keep that that video, but otherwise it should be erased.
Erica, this is the citizens' information because it was gathered in their name, and citizens own it.
Well, I mean, I partly agree with the ACLU. I mean, I don't think that we should be posting videos to YouTube of officers going into people's homes, of officers going to Harborview and talking to people in the ER. I think that is the kind of thing that could actually inhibit people from calling the police if they know that whatever crisis they're in at that moment, whether it's domestic violence or, you know, or gang violence or whatever, is going to be recorded and put online. I do think, though, that that the idea that, you know, I mean, I would want to see the details of how soon these videos just get deleted and erased from existence, because if there's a statute of limitations, say 60 days, and, you know, it becomes clear that an incident had involved police misconduct or involved one of these conditions that the ACLU is talking about, it would be good to have that video around and still available in some form, even if not posted to YouTube. And I mean, in terms of resources, Pat's absolutely right. Redacting the faces from all these videos, SPD doesn't have the technology to do that in any kind of timely fashion yet. It's very time consuming and it does take resources. And, you know, I don't know if that's the best way of spending resources. So I would want to see some sort of filter on what gets published and what SPD just hangs on to.
Doesn't that put the ability to decide what's over the line into government hands, Jossie?
Yeah. I mean, I get the considerations. I've done probably 30 FOIA requests in my life.
And you're an attorney.
Yeah.
We're talking Freedom of Information Act
requests.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's onerous. It's burdensome. And there's enough disincentives that a person who just wanted to learn, you know, what a particular person's recipe is, so they're going to use the body cam that went into this particular kitchen, you know, they're not going to do that. Moreover, the redaction / the technology that can obscure faces, for example, that's available on any particular app. Like, you could do that on Instagram, on your smartphone. And so it's not a particularly difficult standard in order to make this stuff available. I don't really buy that argument. But I think, and I, if I can just digress for 2 seconds, Bill, I think that this is also an interesting topic because it just shows it's a red herring. You know, at some point, these body cam conversations all come back to the same place of, yes, that's cool. We're going to have this incredible device to be able to see Walter Scott as he's killed and not necessarily be able to do anything about it, because the standard in order to convict one of these officers of any wrongdoing, which is the malice standard, has remained unchanged. And so all of this stuff, you know, these technological advances are sort of pyrrhic. They're sort of rhetorical, because the substance they're under, which is that we want accountability, is just not there. These body cams don't do anything about that. And preventing footage from being released to the public, where maybe we can at least win a victory in the eye of the public, the court of public opinion. Well, now we don't even have that opportunity because we've obscured that.
I just want to respond to the looking at the recipe example. As someone who, you know, who follows neighborhood social media pretty closely, I really worry that it would be used for, you know, if you witness or if you hear a domestic violence situation going on in your neighbor's yard or your neighbor's house or apartment, and you're nosy, and a lot of people are very nosy about their neighbors. You can go and get that footage and find out what happened. And
you could call the cops, then they show up. And then you get that footage?
Well, that's one scenario. But, I mean, the point is, you know, allowing people to poke into their neighbor's business or to poke into, you know, people's private business in general, you know, the domestic violence victim, you know, while I want domestic violence victims to go to the police, I don't know that, you know, as if that was me, that I would want that video being published to the entire world.
Well, I think the redacting isn't the real issue. It's finding the actual footage, going through hours and hours and hours of tape to find what the person's requesting in the first place.
Aren't we scarily getting better at that?
Maybe. But I think that all videos should be reviewed by a couple of citizens, maybe one that really can't stand the police and somebody that has a little more balanced approach. And either person could vote that it gets bumped up for review by the OPA or whatever. And then keep anything that's questionable. For example, I think Officer Whitlatch, who was fired by SPD, probably had a long history of really horrible engagements with citizens.
This is the officer who stopped the guy with an African-American with a golf club.
Right. And so her encounters should have been put into archives. I think there is probably a history there.
I just want to make sure that, in case our listeners don't follow this as closely as we do, that, Jossie, you're saying that the police can institute dash cams and body cams and then say, look what we've done. We're transparent now. Except it's very, very difficult for pretty understandable reasons. I mean, it's difficult, right, to prove to send a police officer to jail for using force in the line of duty is very difficult. That's another whole other topic, but it doesn't mean that body cameras don't mean convictions of police officers.
That's
right. Is that what you're saying?
There's no direct nexus between the two. It's almost impossible. So I'm going to amend your amendment
a little bit.
It's almost impossible because, and even with the advanced technology, and that's not to say there's not a place for the technology, but it's to say that if there's no revisions to the legislative format, the legislative framework, that with you, it's almost impossible to prove from a camera angle that's, you know, pointing in one direction that this person had malice toward this particular perpetrator or alleged perpetrator. And through that, you know, there's no increase and there's been no empirical increase in places that have done body cams. And there's plenty of places across the United States that shows there's been an increase in police accountability. Now, there has been a decrease in incidents. And so we should be thankful for that, I suppose. But to the degree that this, you know, allows any amount of absolution to police accountability, no, I don't buy it.
Okay, we're going to move on now. But we've been talking about who gets to see the footage that all those coming body cameras are going to record. And your lawmakers, local and state, are going to keep on debating that. And we'll keep following it on the Week in Review. We have one more topic to bring you. And we're so excited about it, as you'll hear. Okay, this week the BBC exposed the scandal of our times over exclaiming. Grammar expert Caroline Taggart urges you, when you send an email, a text, a post, a tweet, use words to express yourself. Cool it with the multiple exclamation marks.
If you do it all the time, it loses weight. So, yes, do it that once, but don't then do it three times in the same paragraph.
Yes.
No three exclamation marks. This touched my heart because I see the exclamation inflation, and first of all, it's dishonest because you're pretending to be excited when you're not, and it makes you less interesting because your punctuation is substituting for well-chosen words that will actually make your audience feel something specific. And if I were writing what I just said, I would use no exclamation mark because I'm not exclaiming. I'm just saying. Pat Murakami, do you feel me specifically?
Yes, I feel you.
Okay. What do you think?
Well, I think Great Britain is a little uptight, and there are more important issues, but I have no problem with exclamation marks. And I have to say I kind of ignore anything that's sent to me with multiple long strings of exclamation marks. It doesn't impact me. It actually has a reverse effect.
Right, Barnett.
I mean, I think this is sort of man yells at clouds a little bit. It's like, what are those crazy millennials up to now? You know.
I wish it were only millennials.
Well,
go on.
But I mean, I read something about how if you put a period at the end of your text, you're considered less trustworthy, or you know, I mean, whatever. Language changes. Who cares?
Okay.
I use exclamation marks, and frankly. You know,
but
because,
why?
Because,
why?
Well, I'll tell you, because language changes and because
this
if I hit a sore spot.
Yeah.
It did. Because I use exclamation marks. And the reason I do is because if you don't, you're considered kind of rude. Like, it seems like you're not being friendly if you're just like, great idea. It reads like sarcasm. Like,
this
oh,
is what I want. You're right.
Idea.
You're exactly right. And I want to know, why are we assuming that the worst of other people? Why would we assume that somebody is sarcastic or attacking?
Because that's the only way you can communicate tone now is by the way, you know, did I put, you know, a space before the exclamation mark? That means something. Did I put it in parentheses? That
it's
means
so
something.
Fearful.
Oh,
so negative,
because we don't talk on the phone anymore.
Yeah. You know, this caused a deep existential crisis. You know, I've pondered for the past week since I heard about this news. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then I started thinking, well, when I write LOL, am I really LOLing?
Thank you. You are probably not.
That's right. Exactly. Because I'm probably not going to be able to write if I'm LOL. LMAO. Well, my posterior is still there.
Yes.
It's not off.
I can see it. It's not off.
Right. So I think that we're just in the generation where we're comfortable with hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's okay. I think that that's fine. And it might be a millennial thing. I don't know. But I think that's okay.
This is what emojis are for, people.
That's right.
Because then you're not claiming anything. You're just putting a picture.
Oh,
you
but
couldn't think of
so
anything
much,
else to say.
So much ambiguity within emojis, Bill.
Yeah, that's the beauty. No one could pin you down. They don't know why you put a picture of an eggplant.
They know why.
And that smirking emoji. Oh, my God.
Okay. Are we done reviewing the week's news? The top most important news?
I think we hit it.
We are. The clock says we are. Jossie Ross, attorney, local writer. Good to see you again.
It's wonderful seeing you, Bill.
Erica C. Barnett at the C is for crank.com.
Exclamation mark.
Exclamation mark.
Two exclamation marks.
exclamation mark, I guess. Pat Murakami, South Seattle, neighborhood activist, president of the South Seattle Crime Prevention Council. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
We're live tweeting the show. Please tweet back at us. Remember, you only have so many characters. Don't waste them on the line with the period underneath it. Kara McDermott is live tweeting us at KUOW. Week in Review is produced by Amina Al-Sadi. Yeah, thanks, Kara. And thank you for listening. We'll do it again next week.
Thank
okay.
you, Bill.
All right. Bye.